Hi, everyone, and welcome back to the MIP, the Male Infertility Podcast. And I'm your host, Nick. Shock horror. So this is episode 16 of the podcast. I apologize now that it's been a couple of weeks since I've released an episode, but I have been a little bit busy. I've been doing some audiobooks and so on, and it does take up a fair bit of time. So apologies for that. But we have a episode today, which is all good. And I do have another one, which should be coming in a week's time, I think. So you know there's a couple coming. Anyway, I do have one little request before I continue. Anybody listening on Apple Podcasts, would it be possible for you guys to maybe give me a little cheeky review? I just want to get some feedback, and supposedly the more reviews you get, the more people will find the podcast. And obviously, we want as many people to find the podcast and be helped as possible. So I would greatly appreciate that if you don't mind. And you're thinking, what's today's episode going to be about? Well, I can tell you right now, it's an interview with Vince. He's from Canada, not originally, but he can tell you all about that in his story. And this is a really good interview. I had a really good chat with him. And well, I just want to crack on really. But I do have to say, I apologize now. My audio isn't the best, but please stick with it. There's a lot of good information in this one. So anyway, I'm going to stop rambling on now. Without further ado, here's the interview. Hi, everyone, and welcome to the MIP. Today, we're interviewing Vince all the way from London in Canada. That's Canada, not the UK. And well, here he is, Vince.
Nick, it's great to be with you today. I like to joke, I'm in the other London, you know, because everyone knows London, but they're like, you're in the UK. I'm like, no, the other one. They're usually disappointed, but hey, London's a great place to be from. I grew up in the States. My wife and I, Lori, we're celebrating 26 years this year. You know, we moved to Canada in the early 2000s. For work and to be close to her family. And we've made it home ever since. And although I like to joke about, you know, our London being sort of a lesser London, I mean, because who can compare it to like London? Nah. It is a pretty great place to be from. Absolutely. Thanks for having me on, Nick.
No, it's good to have you on, mate. It's good to have you on. My first Canadian on the podcast. So,
woo, all right.
Just, yeah. Yeah. So,
So Canadian, eh?
Canadian, a boot.
I just had to get the A in there. You know, that's how it goes there, right?
That's cool. So, right. Tell us a little bit about your journey.
Yeah, absolutely. So I mentioned a moment ago, Lori and I have been together for 26 years. That's super exciting. We're just sort of marveling, amazed at that as time has gone on. But we discovered about 16 years ago, a little longer than that actually, that I was infertile. So we were living in Pennsylvania at the time. We were working there, and you know, the kids just weren't coming. Nick, I don't know. I listened to your podcast. I can't recall particularly for your guys' story what the trigger was. But for us, it was, you know, we kind of quit taking the pill for a while, a year, maybe 18 months, and nothing was happening. And we're kind of like, well, that seemed a little odd. So we decided to get it checked out. I mean, like, how long did you guys go?
Well, we were, really trying, as in like, yeah, around the 2-year mark. But To be fair, we weren't using any protection. So
for sure,
if things had been working right, she could have been up the duff 50 times. I mean,
that's right.
but yeah, the similar situation to you. You know what I mean? Literally, like,
so you just keep trying, right? You're trying. And you're just like, you know, and everyone says this is going to happen. You know, everyone's got a story. Well, we couldn't do it, and then one night we relaxed, or we had our margaritas, or you know, whatever, right? Everybody's got a story about how, you know, quote unquote nature, you know, and there's this sort of assumption that nature is the better way. Nature's just going to take over. And, you know, for us, you know, this went on for a while, and we're kind of thinking, you know, maybe there's something wrong. And I remember thinking, Nick, I had this notion of sort of the typical guy and I don't think this is necessarily fair to guys, but I had this notion that it would be a guy thing to blame it on my wife, right? It would just be like, you know, she's got all the complicated tubes and stuff, right?
I think the first thing that springs to your mind, definitely, or the stereotypical way of thinking, it would definitely be, you'd probably think, oh, there's got to be something with the woman.
It's more complicated. What have I got? You know, a couple of small tubes, that's it, right? You know, I don't have like eggs and ovaries and all this stuff, right? So you're thinking that would be maybe a way to go. And I was just kind of irritated by that view. I was like, you know what? Getting me tested is trivial. So I said, honey, you know what? I'm just going to go. I'm going to go to the doctor. We're going to test this out. And, you know, obviously that's a really simple procedure, you know, and, you know, there's a cup and you're done. And, you know, like a week later, I get the lab results back and from my doctor, and the doctor says, yeah, well, I never liked that lab anyway. That's not a good sign.
What?
Yeah, I never liked that lab anyway.
So just to take one step back, did you actually have to do it in the doctor's?
30 minutes. They wanted the sample within 30 minutes. And I was about a 20-minute drive from the doctor's office. Gave me a cup and they said, you know, do your thing. And so I had to drive it down there and drop it off.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. Similar.
So, yeah. You know, when the doctor leads with, I never liked that lab anyway, you know, something's wrong. So we tried it again. Mm-hmm. And nothing. And he said, well, this just can't be right. There's no sperm. So he said, you know what? I'm going to refer you to a urologist. We were living kind of in what we call the sticks in the middle of nowhere for our job. And he said, look, I'm going to send you down to Pittsburgh and you're going to see your urologist down there, you know, and they're going to help you out. So I was like, okay, all right. You know, again, I'm healthy. I never had any reason to believe I'd have any problems. You know what I'm saying? Like, it just never, you know, maybe if you had, you know, cancer as a kid or something, you might be wondering about your future fertility. But for us, it was just like, we were really worried about not having kids when we didn't want them, right? You know, not, you know what I'm saying? So, and then as you can empathize here, all that turned out to be a lot of wasted worry, right? As it turned out, avoiding the unexpected pregnancy was way easier than we thought it would.
I remember, to be fair, I remember when me and the missus first got together, there was a few times where we initially did it without protection. And I remember her telling me, I want to say 3 or 4 times where she had to go to the doctors to get the morning after pill.
Sure.
And if you think about that now, it's like, what a waste of bloody money.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's kind of, it's like in the category of so funny, you either laugh or cry, right? Like, you can cry or you just laugh it off, right? So we went down to Pittsburgh, and long story short, the urologist said, look, I want to take a testicular biopsy. And as you know, that's as fun as it sounds. Mm. And so, you know, we did the procedure, and my family was really supportive. I grew up in Indiana, which was about an 8-hour drive from where we were living. And my parents drove over, you know, to support us at the hospital. It was kind of an outpatient thing, right?
Yeah.
And, you know, they came all the way over to offer emotional support. And we did the biopsy. And I don't know, I'm making it up at this point, but maybe it was a week later. I can't remember. The urologist calls me back down to Pittsburgh, which is about a 2-hour drive, for, you know, the results. So, I mean, there's no surprise, we're on the MIP. So obviously the results were nada, you know, nothing. But I remember going into the doctor's office and I had to make the trip alone. I was worried, you know, I was trying to be a good little employee, right? I didn't want to be off work. My wife was still working, you know, and I had to drive down there and it was burning most of the day and or at least half a day. And, and I got down there and sitting in this, you know, cold, dim exam room waiting for the doctor to come in. He comes in and says, look, there's nothing. There's no sperm.
Yeah.
And he used the word azoospermia, which was the first time I'd ever had heard that word in my life.
Yeah.
And, you know, I mean, I believe he meant well. His bedside manner could have possibly used some improvement, but I think really and this kind of gets to some larger issues in the fertility world, there's just an underutilization of counseling. And so he walks in to deliver the news and he says, look, you know, we didn't find anything. You might consider a donor or adoption. Good luck.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, that was basically it, right? I'm really not exaggerating.
Yep. So there you go, mate. See ya.
There you go. You know, and I remember, you know, I was all about, look, stiff upper lip, you know, I gotta be positive. And I said, you know, I'm sure this thing's going to work out. And, you know, I really appreciate your time, Doc. And I got out in the parking garage and I started driving back north from Pittsburgh. And you're just driving and you're thinking and you're driving and you're thinking. And about an hour from home, about halfway home, I was just not handling it so well, right? Like it kind of like crashed over you like a wave.
Yeah.
And I'm like, no, 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 I'm good, man. I'm good. It'll all be good. And there was a state park that we'd visited before, and I saw the exit for it. And I thought, you know, I'm trying to be a good little employee. I want to rush back to work, you know, not miss a work day, but I need some time.
Yeah, definitely.
And I just pulled off into this park. And I remember it was winter. There was snow on the ground. And this was a beautiful park that had a river running through it. And I pulled into the parking lot. And I remember seeing a guy kayaking down the river. And I thought, that guy's crazy. You know, it's like freezing outside. But, you know, here he was kayaking down a river. And I just started weeping, man. I just broke down.
Yeah.
I couldn't believe this had happened to me. I didn't know what it meant. Why me? You know, what do we do now? I just knew that having kids was always important to us. Lori and I had always talked about, you know, having a big family. I was one of two. She was one of four.
Yeah.
And we kind of had this romantic notion of, you know, five or six kids and this busy house and all of this sort of excitement. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I know exactly what you're saying. Definitely. I mean, it sounds as if, when you were driving and obviously you pulled into that state park or whatever, the reality of it all just hit you.
Oh, wow.
It hit you.
Wow. Like, and it just hurt.
Like Mike Tyson hitting you around the chops.
That's it. That's a good reference. Absolutely. It really hurt. And, you know, and at the same time, you know, this is all new, right? Like, we've all dealt with disappointment and grief before. And, you know, the models that we've used or we've drawn on to deal with that, you know, have involved a fair bit of self-recrimination, you know, suck it up, be tough, you know, don't let things get to you. You're being selfish. You need to move on. And so all those thoughts are running through your head, or running through my head, while I'm just sobbing over my steering wheel thinking, you know, I'm sure we'll figure something out. But right now I can't think it through.
Yeah.
And it just really hurts. And am I being selfish to acknowledge that it hurts, right? Like, so those were the things I'm thinking at the time.
Yeah, the thing is, at the end of the day, at that point in time, we don't really realize the magnitude of it. I mean, someone's saying a load of words that unless you've really done your research, like you say, you'd never heard of azoospermia before. And then someone drops a bit of jargon like that towards you and you're like, yeah, okay, mate. So basically you're telling me that I can't have kids. And then you
I can't make babies, right?
Yeah, and then
I can't make babies.
And then you've gone away, you've thought about it, and it's hit you, and it's completely understandable, mate. I mean, I'm pretty sure unless you're the hardest mother F in the world, you're gonna have a breakdown at some point. You're gonna shed a tear. I mean, it's completely natural.
It's such a blow to your expectations, right? I mean, life is really expectation management. And as much as we know that or might acknowledge it, we still maybe don't do so well at it. I know I don't. And I know I had a lot of expectations wrapped up around this role that I was going to play of fathering these children, right?
Yeah.
And what it meant for my identity, you know, what it meant to be a real man.
Yeah.
You know,
the classic.
I think we do this ignorantly, right? In society.
Yeah.
You know, it's not that we mean to hurt people who can't have children, but I mean, you know, what are the basic differences between the genders? Well, guys can make babies, right? And so it just becomes one of those default, you know, tests of your manhood that you can make a baby, right? And now all of a sudden you heard that you can't.
Yeah, it is. It's literally like, So if there's a guy like, I don't know, he's whatever sort of guy, and he's got five kids, he's like, yeah, I'm a real man. You know what I mean?
Yeah, look at me. I make babies. Yeah. Like, I look at them and babies come out, right?
they all live in squalor, but I can, you know what I mean? I can keep the wife can pop them out and all that. But no, there's, at the end of the day, we're all just as manly as each other, I think, anyway. We just got dealt that really bad hand, and we've just got to learn to live with it. In whatever
way we
can. We
got to learn to redefine. Yeah, we've got to redefine what it means to be a guy, right? Like, naturally, the biological angle is the obvious one, you know? And we're surrounded by various examples of culture where, you know, somebody's, you know, fertility, you know, points to them being, you know, quote unquote, the better man. But I think we all learned the hard way. And I know I certainly did over years to redefine what it means to be a man. But in that moment, sitting there in that park, you're having all these thoughts, and then you're feeling guilty for having all these thoughts. At least I was, you know, that I should just be getting on with it, that I should be tougher. And then I started thinking about, well, how did this happen?
Yeah.
So, I mean, Nick, is that fair? I mean, did you go through that whole sort of life soul searching, you know, is this my fault? You know, how did this happen to me?
Well, to be fair, I'll be honest. Initially, yes, I was thinking, I mean,
absolutely.
I didn't drink a lot, I'll be honest, but I'm a professional smoker. So it was like, did that have anything to do with it? But then
you start going through an inventory. Yeah.
And all that stuff and everything, all the stuff that I've spoke about in the past. But then ultimately, when we went to do the, I went for the micro-tessie, and I found out all of that stuff. I needed clarification from the doctor when I got the results. I needed to hear it from him that it was nothing that I ever did that made this happen.
That's right.
I needed him to tell me that it was...
it was just a bad hand. You just got dealt a bad hand.
Yeah, yeah, it's natural. You know what I mean? Natural as you can get, but
I follow you, right? Because bad things happen in nature too, you know, cells miscopy, you know, bad things happen, and they are just as natural as things kind of work in the way we expect, right?
Yeah. So I for me personally, I needed to hear that. I think if it had been something that I'd done in the past, I've never done drugs, but if I had done drugs in the past or something like that, and I've found out that maybe it was due to this, then I may have thought about things very differently.
And I think right now it might be helpful for any guy who's listening to this. You know, it's easy for you and I to talk about it, because in the end, the answer was, it wasn't anything we did. We just got dealt a bad hand.
Yeah.
If somehow you did find out it was something you did, that's going to add to your grief. I still think you can work through it. I obviously can't speak to that from personal experience. But, you know, in my case, you know, I went through this whole inventory, right? Like you were describing, you know, I'd had hernia surgery as an infant. Is that what happened, right? You know, did they cut the wrong thing? Well, we did the fluid tests, and although there was some blockage on one tube, there wasn't on the other. So, you know, but, you know, did that have something to do with it? I remember once, like in junior high, you know, there was this period in junior high, maybe you didn't experience this, but where I went to junior high, where, you know, guys thought it was funny to kick each other in the nuts, right? Yeah. I don't know. They thought that was hilarious. And they double over, they just surprise you and they kick you and be like, ha ha ha. Yes. Isn't that funny? And
to be fair,
I myself never participate. That wasn't my thing.
I do at work. Not so much now. But before, we just walk past each other and just kind of flick each other and just be like, shh. I mean, you'd double over, wouldn't you? And be like, oh.
just messing with each other. And, you know, like you, drinking and drugs really weren't part of my lifestyle. And I wasn't particularly, you know, jocular like that, didn't engage in that. But I remember once in junior high when some guy thought it was funny and he kicked me hard. And, you know, is that what did it? You know, I mean, I think we should just call it out. every guy who goes through this also wonders if it was, you know, wanking off, right? Like, did I, it was supposed to make me blind. That didn't happen. Is it, am I infertile now, right? You know what I'm saying? Let's just be honest, right? You go through this inventory and you go, oh my word, what caused this to happen? Yeah. And in the end, you know, it's not your fault. No. And even if you engage in some behavior that might have contributed to it, I think that's pretty doubtful anyway. Yeah. You know, it's not your fault, but you go through that, right? And so I went through it. I went through this kind of worry. And then it was followed by, you know, what are we going to do and how do we cope with it? So, you know, I think I got in the story here to, you know, crying over the steering wheel. Well, we went on, and quite frankly, I didn't know what to do. We actually let several years go by before we did anything else about it. In part, I will tell you the truth, we were hoping for a miracle.
Yeah. Right? So everybody said. You were still holding out that just in case, maybe in there somewhere, maybe they got it wrong or something like that. That
we're going to go on vacation, we're going to relax, yep. You know, when you least expect it. Yep. Or if it's not one of those stories, we're actually hoping maybe for some kind of divine intervention. You know, there would be some answer to prayer, some miracle that would happen that would cause
the midichlorians come down and next thing you know.
Yeah, that doesn't work out so well for those characters, but
yeah, there is that.
So we sat on it for a couple of years, and during that time period, we had an opportunity to take work closer to Lori's family, and we moved to the other London, as we already established. Mm-hmm. And we'd gone from a situation where we were very underpaid. It was really sort of a labor of love in Pennsylvania. And we were on very basic assisted insurance at the time, to a situation where, as a landed immigrant, we had access to coverage for our healthcare. So one of those coverages included having a family doctor and being able to investigate fertility things. And so it wasn't long after we moved here and started contributing to the economy and paying our taxes and being good citizens that we said, you know what, this insurance coverage, I mean, that's what we really mean by universal healthcare, right? This insurance coverage is provided for us and recognizes that starting a family is an important thing and a value to society, and it's there for us. Why don't we investigate this?
Yeah, just to clarify, the Canadian health system similar to the US?
Yeah, I mean, having grown up in the States where it was all a matter of private insurance, perhaps subsidized by your employer, although we'd personally also gone through being self-insured. Right. Here in Canada, the federal government requires each province to run essentially an insurance scheme for every citizen, right? Okay. And so in Ontario, it's called the Ontario Health Insurance Program, OHIP, the plan. And it's basically a single payer insurance situation, and it covers a variety of things. And it covered, you know, another trip to a urologist. Right. So we went to the urologist, to the fertility clinic. He offered to do another biopsy. I passed. Said no thanks. That was good. Good first time around. I'm done with that. And so we started talking about donor sperm, and at the same time we started investigating adoption. So we didn't know which way we wanted to go. Mm-hmm. And maybe at this point in the story, it's helpful to say that we went to this overnight, this retreat, if you will, put on by an adoption agency a couple hours away. We're trying to get our head around how to do adoption, whether adoption was for us. And it was the most powerful experience we've ever been through. And it really changed my life, as we'll get to eventually here, with what we do today to support folks who are going through infertility, and particularly donor conception. Mm-hmm. But we spent this overnight, the sort of most of a weekend, for the first time with 20 other couples who were going through the same thing.
Wow.
And that was powerful. You know, we knew we weren't alone. Like, we get it. There's a certain percentage of the population that's infertile. Everybody knows that sort of older couple who never had kids, and you never really ask them if they tried, but probably... Yeah. they did, you know, and they don't have kids. And, you know, we'd known a couple of those folks in our lives, but we didn't know anyone our age who was going through this. No one our age was talking about it, right?
Yeah.
And so we found ourselves in this adoption seminar, this adoption workshop. And in Ontario, the adoption practice has evolved away from it all being a big secret and, you know, lie to your kids and pretend that their parents died in the car wreck or something or whatever, to recognizing that adoptees have very real needs around understanding who their biological progenitors are. And so the adoption conference was entirely centered around this. You're infertile and that really, really sucks. And you need to make space to grieve that.
Yeah.
Because whatever you do in the future is not going to replace the child you can't have and that you're never going to have, probably, right? That's why you're here, because you've given up hope that you're going to be able to make a child sort of the natural way.
That's a good point.
And that's okay. And you got to grieve, because in order to move beyond and start making decisions that can allow for and consider the best interests of the child you're going to bring into the family, you have to stop just trying to paper this over and fix it and make it go away and pretend it never really happened.
Yeah.
You know, it did happen. And it's okay to grieve that. And you have permission to grieve. Like, I don't know why we sometimes need permission from other people, right? But
yeah, I think it's just the way we're wired.
Yeah. And it helps for someone to say, it's okay for you to grieve. In fact, a lot of people grieve this. And here's some help working through your grief, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so the first part of that seminar, that Friday night, was just all about make space to grieve. Recognize your loss.
I could imagine that you and your wife and all the other couples in that situation, I bet there was a hell of a lot of emotions going on in that room, I can imagine.
Wow, it's powerful, right? Yeah. It's powerful. I mean, this is why these things are private, right? You know, most of us have sort of a public mask, a persona. Mm. We have a reputation we're maintaining. We don't want to, you know, crack that in front of just any stranger. We're afraid of what kind of, how people might use that to try to get advantage over us. And that's true, you know, especially among guys about being infertile, right? Oh, you're infertile, you know? So here we are in this room, and we're really considering for the first time that we really have experienced a loss, that we can identify with that, that that's something we can grieve, and that's okay to grieve. In fact, it's healthy to grieve. And then the conference went on to say, as you work through your grief and you start to look at, say, adopting a child, in Ontario, we do all adoptions unless there's like some really strong security reason, as open adoptions, which means you're going to meet the biological parent.
Okay.
And that child will have that ability to know who that parent is. And maybe even they were even encouraging the notion that you establish some kind of social relationship, even while the child is still a child.
Right.
And that you could find ways to work out boundaries together that didn't challenge your notion of whether it was your child and whether the child was going to be taken away from you and the parent or not.
Yeah.
Because, of course, as soon as you start talking about alternative family building, you start worrying about the bogeyman. The people are going to come and take your child away from you or question your right to parent. And one of those persons, you imagine, or at least I know we did, and I don't think we're abnormal, was, you know, the actual biological progenitor of the child.
I could imagine that.
But their point was,
that would be quite an interesting situation to be put in, though, because you, in a way, you're putting the child completely first in the whole situation, because you're obviously, there's going to be people who adopt a child and they're like, it's our child now. Like the mum and dad didn't want to know about it. This is ours now. They would find it very difficult, I think, to be accepting of the fact that the mother would then still potentially have a part of the child's growth and development and everything else. I mean, me personally, I don't know how I would feel in that situation.
It's threatening. It's threatening to the notion. I mean, we have children for a variety of reasons. I've thought this through. I think for me, it's true to say I wanted to have children. because I wanted to experience that unconditional love that a child brings. And you can call, you know, these motives selfish, but they're very normal, right?
Oh, yeah.
Otherwise, why would we go through the pain? You know, I mean, there have to be, in nature, there are pluses that make up for the minuses, right? Yeah. And one of those is the pleasure we get, you know, from the adoration and love and affection from the children we create, whether they're from our own loins or whether they're, you know, brought into our family another way. And then we want to create a legacy. At least I know I did. So I wanted to enjoy that affection and the mutual affection, the giving and receiving of affection with my children. Yeah. And I wanted to pass on my legacy. And the idea that someone else might be known to this child and might threaten my status as parent, especially as you enter this up front, that's really scary. I'm going to tell you today, I'm not worried about it at all. But back then, it was this huge unknown. And you know, our brains are wired to find threats, right? Yeah. And so we're thinking, oh man, you know, I'm never going to tell the kid, right? We got to keep this a secret, got to whatever. And they're saying to us, look, keeping this a secret is about you papering over your infertility.
Yeah.
You just need to cope with it. And it's hard and it hurts and it's okay. And you need to grieve it. Now let's move on and consider what we know about children who grow up, children who find out as adults that their perception of reality has not been true, you know, in terms of, yeah. you know, their biological origins, et cetera. And because people, we ascribe meaning to genetic origins, right? In one sense, it's how we define who gets to eat dinner here tonight and who has to go home to their house.
Yeah.
The simplest definition of family is that we're related, right? Yeah. Now, we all know that family can be built, you know, a lot of different ways, and it doesn't necessarily involve what we call blood relations, but that's kind of the default mode. So anyway, this conference was fantastic, and it really expanded our thinking, and it just really resonated with our values. We didn't want to be keeping big secrets from our kids. We didn't want to be bearing that guilt and hiding truths and risking discovery. Yeah. And frankly, we had leaned on so many people for support during this journey. The decision to use donor sperm was not for us a trivial one. It wasn't for me. And we had leaned on my parents and my brother and my wife's sister and other folks for support. We were really creating a situation where our kid would be the only one in the room who didn't know.
Yeah, we wouldn't want that. I mean, we're going to be open with our baby to... No, obviously not straight away, but like once they're able to understand, then we will tell them, definitely. I mean, I've joked about it on the podcast before, but there ain't going to be any hard in it when your dad does a male infertility podcast.
That's right. And none of us would want to disadvantage our children by them being the only one in the room who doesn't know this possibly important fact about themselves, right? That's not cool. We wouldn't want to be that person. We don't want to do that to our kids. So we went through this conference and it helped us think about how we would go forward. But we eventually decided that adoption really wasn't for us for a couple of reasons. Mm-hmm. One of them was, quite frankly, Lori wanted to carry a baby. Mm-hmm. And I could not for the life of me come to the conclusion that that was unreasonable or selfish.
Yeah, I agree.
It's a part of her gender and her identity. And it's a perfectly natural thing. Like we can go back thousands of years in written human documents. I mean, if you want to go back to the Bible, you can go to the book of Genesis and see that the inability to bear children is a common and grieved experience for women.
Yeah. I mean, I think at the same time,
you just have to go back to Jacob and his wives, right? Yeah. So, I mean, as a testimony or a documentation that this is an important angst among humans, especially those who experience infertility.
Right? Yeah, I think from a male, if a man turned around to his wife or partner and said, right, so I'm infertile, but I don't want to use donor sperm. You know what I mean? Or let's go down the adoption route. You know what I mean? Because I don't want you to go down. I don't want you to be pregnant. I want you to have like adopt as well. It sounds a little bit stupid, but it's equally as unbiological as each other, because the man may perceive that he's it's not as much his child, maybe, if it's just the woman having it,
yeah,
and it's with a donor sperm. I mean, I don't think that way, but there's always going to be different people who
think, what do you think guys do
these crazy thoughts, and because everybody is different, and it would just be purely selfish in my thinking to not at least give it a chance for your partner or wife to have the opportunity to go through pregnancy.
So Nick, you raise a great point, and I think this is a great time to discuss it. In our support group work, we do run into couples where that works out differently for them, where the spouses don't feel comfortable with the perceived sort of power imbalance around who's genetically related and who's not. Mm. Or there isn't a compelling drive on the female part to bear the baby, right? Mm-hmm. So I think those are fair approaches too. For us, it was kind of very traditional, right? She wanted to carry a kid. I just couldn't see how that was a thing that I should stand in the way of. And, you know, I saw my role as getting my head around how we would go forward. But I was meeting with a guy for a little while who was thinking about donor conception. I like to say, I'm not here to sell donor conception. I'm here to help you think it through.
Yeah.
And, you know, he and I were meeting for lunch every now and then in Toronto. And he personally could not get his head around the idea of, quote unquote, another guy's sperm making his wife pregnant. And that's valid. Like that's not how I saw it, but I can understand it. Right.
Yeah.
And I can see that perspective. And eventually they went on to adopt. And he asked me to write a referral letter, which I was so, so happy to do. I don't know a guy who's been more thoughtful in his intentions become apparent,
I mean,
than this guy.
I mean, right? Even in our situation or whatever, I'm pretty sure that there's always going to be that part of you where you do think what he thought. Maybe you don't agree with it completely, but for maybe a split second or a couple of seconds or an hour, sure, you're thinking that same thing. There's going to be another man's sperm impregnating
100%.
my wife. And until you can get over that and understand it and just compute it really, then you won't get over it. You need to, if you know what I'm trying to get at.
It's perfectly natural. You and I have both thought that. And I certainly thought it too. I think for us, one of the ways we coped with it was by medicalizing it all, right? So these days you can just download an app and, you know, get a casual hookup to get pregnant if you want to, right? I'm not really sure how that blurs the line between, you know, just a hookup app or whatever, but, you know, without giving them any airtime here, these things exist. And for us, the clinical approach let us draw a distinction between this other man's role, right? It wasn't romantic. We're not confused about that. You know, my wife told me, I already picked my guy. I don't want to look through this sperm donor catalog, right? I mean, that was a reaction she had early on. I already picked my guy, right? You know, and you pick a partner based on a bunch of cues and experiences and a lot of vetting, and now all of a sudden you're staring at a list with maybe a baby photo and a few details and a write-up that frankly you don't even know if it's true or not, right? Where they talk about their family history and whatever. Yeah. And you're picking like it's a dating site. And my wife's initial reaction was, you know, I don't want to have, it's not fair. I don't want to have to pick someone else. I picked you. And of course I cried then too, but you know, for us, going the clinical route really helped tease apart this notion of the other man, right, and the other man's role. But I do know guys who struggle with that, and it's perfectly legitimate. And if that's you listening, know that that's legitimate. That's a part of your process, and that you should not feel bad about thinking that way.
So I think it's only right that when you're going through this, there's going to be so many things entering your head. I think it's only right that you should not entertain every thought, but at least think about everything that you possibly can. And because you're going to react to so many different ways, and there's so many thoughts that go through your head, that it's only
That's right.
right that you should
That's right.
think about yourself as well, because you, like you said before, you are going through that grieving process and it does take time. And sometimes once you've thought about it for X amount of time, it helps you to understand to whichever route that you're going to go down, whether it be donor or adoption or whatever.
Nick, I agree. I'm a big fan of deliberation and consideration, right? Like, I don't want to get stuck in analysis paralysis, but I do feel it helped us. And so our hospital required counseling, and it was one of the more advanced in that practice, where it was more than just like a screening interview, which I think largely are the doctors making sure you're not crazy and going to sue them, right? You know, and it was a series of conversations about how does donor conception, you know, align with our values? How does it align with, you know, your religion? How does it align with your family and their views? You know, and we did a lot of sort of preparatory thinking, which really helped us, I think, a lot. And I would highly recommend you find a good counselor. You interviewed with Jana Rupnow recently, and I listened to that. You know, she's fantastic. You know, so if you need distance counseling, there's an option. If you just need to talk to other people who've been through it, you know, you and me, that's what we do, you know, as just peers, you know, rather than necessarily professionals. But so I think that thinking was really helpful, and I'm glad we made the time for it. And we found a way to look at that less as being a gatekeeper activity and more as, you know, helping us figure out how we could be healthy, because you're facing a lot of loss. And the loss that we were facing was this genetic continuity. For me, you wouldn't know it to look at me, Nick, but I'm full-blooded Italian.
Yeah.
And that's like a really weird little fact, because I'm tall and blonde. And so the fact that both of my sides of my family tree, you know, a couple generations ago came from Northern Italy, were sort of poor Alpine subsistence farmers. And of course, close enough to the Austrian border that probably there's some Germanic in there, but it doesn't matter. Has always been one of those fun facts I trot out. You know, hey, I bet you're not going to believe this, but I'm full-blooded Italian. You know, I'm not passing that on to my kids.
Yeah.
They're not going to have that story. And so for a long time, I really grieved, and there'd be times when it would just well up inside me and make me really sad. This notion that these sort of stories I told about myself that were tied to my genetic heritage, or at least my understanding of it, you know, were not things I was going to pass along to my kids. And it wasn't until a few years after our kids were born that I began to realize that the things that I had inherited about my genetic history were stories. I mean, I think genes are mostly magic to most of us. You know, it's science, but we don't understand whether you're a good piano player because of your genes, or partly because of your genes, or because of your environment, you know, nature, nurture. You know, the average person can't really speak authoritatively about what role the DNA played in who we became. And what I realized was that my heritage wasn't really about the DNA. It was about the stories. It was about the story of my great-grandfather, who came to Alabama to mine coal and worked for five years to make enough money to bring his family over, right? It's a story about my grandfather on the other side of the family, my mother's side, who was drafted into World War II. And the funny story, because he was a pretty bright man, though he never had much formal education, is that as he went through the line and they asked him what he wanted to be, and while all of his buddies were like, hey, I'm going to be in the infantry, I'm going to be in the tank corps, he looked at the guy behind the table and said, what are you? And the guy said, I'm in the quartermaster corps. And he said, sign me up. So, you know, those stories have nothing to do with the genes, and they have everything to do with the story. And because my kids are my kids, I passed those stories to them. And so when I was able to really see that for me, which is not to deny the genetic heritage is important to the donor conceived person, because they're not going to stay kids. They're going to grow up and they're going to explore that however they want, which is why we picked an ID release donor and all sorts of other stuff. But for me, I found a way to see my heritage not as being about the DNA, but as about being about the stories that I inherited and that I tell my children. And so they are the benefactors of those values that are carried along through those stories just as much as I was, even though there isn't a drop of genes in their blood that came from me. And that was huge for me. And from that point forward, I don't grieve the lack of genetic continuity. A teensy bit, Nick. I mean, I'm a one of two brothers, And so I was the end of my family line. And when you look at it that way, that seems really sad. But when you look at it as what kind of influence am I having on the next generation, I still pass those stories on, even if they're not genetically related. So I just want to get that out of my system and share that with you, because I think being able to transition to a view like that really helped me move past sort of the recurrent grieving episodes about being the end of my family line or being, I don't know, we can be really hard on ourselves. I'm an evolutionary failure because I couldn't make children, right? You know, whatever. Instead, it became, I'm the conduit through which my children inherit these stories and the values we choose to represent.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I'm talking about like heritage and so on. I mean, I spoke about it before, how like my grandparents are from Eastern Europe. One was from Latvia. One was from the former Yugoslavia. So it was Croatia, but he was a Serb. And then similar to like your granddad, he at the end of World War II, he went into Italy. If he'd stayed there, the communists would have got him. And that could have been the end of that. So he then goes over to Italy. There's no one in there. There's like a group of them. They're hoping that the Brits find this group of Croatian or Yugoslav soldiers. And when they go down the line and they're talking to all these people, the English, and they're like, can anybody talk English? And luckily, my granddad could speak English. The rest is history. They brought him over to England, to a place somewhere in Leicestershire. I think it might have been Market Harborough. And he was a translator. So he was there. They were obviously filling out all these forms, like I guess refugee forms or so on. And he was there helping every single person. And
for sure.
Yeah. And obviously that's a story I'll be passing on to my kid.
When you pass that story on, you're passing on your values. There's values there about, you know, taking an opportunity to be educated. There's also just, you know, the celebration of some good luck, right? But then there's also that community value. The tail end of your story is how he helped other people. And so when you share that story, you're sharing your values, and the lack of genetic connection is completely irrelevant.
Mm. Yeah. He wasn't related to him, but at the end of the day, he was there to help them. So, and in the end, when
and he's an influence on your kids, regardless of their genetic connection to him.
Exactly.
And because he influenced you, his story changed you, right?
Yeah. And the good thing is that so many of those Serbs, when they came over to Leicester, to where they are, they stayed in Leicester, and there was a community, and he was a big part of the community. We would have these things once a year where they call them Slavas. So you'd celebrate your family Saints Day, which is in November. And obviously when I was really young, they used to be massive because everyone was still alive and so on. But
And they really identified with that ethnic history.
Yeah,
for sure.
Yeah. Obviously there were so many of them. They'd get together, there'd be mates and so on. And I just think that was really good, the fact that they all helped each other. So. But yeah, I just thought I'd throw that in there. But obviously, it will be a story that I will then pass on to.
Absolutely, it is, Nick. So. You're going to pass that story on, and it's not going to matter a hill of beans whether they're genetically, your children are genetically related, because that story influenced you, and now it's going to influence the next generation.
Yeah.
And when I realized that really kind of leads maybe into one more thing, you know, we could talk about, which is, you know, we've shared a bit about, you know, how did we get the news? How did we react? How did we cope? The grieving process, how we decided what to do afterward, you know, and finding ways through grief. But it was really important to me to find a way to give back.
Yeah.
And so it's still fairly uncommon, although certainly it's more common now than it was 10 or 15 years ago, for guys to speak up and say, hey, I am infertile. I can't make babies. And here's how I'm coping with that. And other guys, if you're going through that, you don't have to go through it alone. and you can benefit from talking with other guys. You know, 15 years ago, that was even less common than it is today. And there was there's a chance even today, it's hardly common. And even today, there's a chance to give back. So it was really important to me when the social worker who founded a support group for families who were using donor sperm and egg, she had founded the support group in 1997. Her name is Jean. And she had been our counselor at the hospital in the early 2000s. We went through this. And I've failed to mention so far, but our kids are 15, 13, and 9 now.
Okay.
They're all born from the same sperm donor.
Yeah.
When she retired from active duty at the hospital in 2010, she was looking for a parent to coordinate and organize these support group meetings to keep the work going. And she felt like it was appropriate to transition it from kind of a professional-led thing to a peer-led support thing. And so I had the opportunity to step in and do that. And for the last 10 years, we've been convening and facilitating support group conversations in London and Toronto and some points in between with, you know, 40, sometimes 60, 80 folks who have one thing in common. They all are building or want to build their family with donor sperm or donor eggs. Mm-hmm. And we're really inspired by the Donor Conception Network in the UK. I enjoyed the opportunity. I was actually in London about 2 years ago for the Donor Conception Network's 25th anniversary. And I got to sit down with Walter Merricks and Olivia Montucci and talk about our work here and really just express appreciation for the books that they write, the material they publish, and the leadership they show in reducing stigma around donor sperm and donor eggs and in encouraging openness with your children about their genetic identity, about the circumstance of their origin. And so that's a work that we do here, and we're super excited. We just registered as a not-for-profit here in Canada. Our name is now Donor Conception Canada, and our mandate is to provide these kind of conversations for people. You know, whether you're just looking into donor conception, and you, frankly, you just need to meet some people and decide how weird they are. Right? Are these people normal? Is this a thing normal people do? Is there someone else going through what I'm going through?
Yeah.
And the answer is yes, I think you'll find. And yes, those conversations are really super helpful. And it was, we started attending the support group before our eldest was conceived. And then, you know, there's folks who are going through various stages of their journey. How do I talk to my children? When do I talk to my children? And you know, a conversation that often emerges is that the telling about donor conception is not an event, it's a process.
Yeah.
And when our eldest was just born, we bought a book or two through some recommendations from DCN or elsewhere, and we put it in kind of the rotation of the kids' stories. And for the first 4 or 5 years, we probably told the story a few dozen times reading this book. Of course, our eldest, she doesn't remember a thing, right? It didn't matter to her. But what mattered was we were practicing the words and becoming comfortable with sharing the story so that it wasn't somehow embarrassing or shameful for us. Yeah. So that we weren't telegraphing an unease with the story. And so it's become such a regular part of our kids' understanding of their own existence that when you ask them today, when did you first learn that you weren't genetically related to your dad and that there's a sperm donor involved, they can't even tell you.
Yeah.
But it's a process because it isn't just sort of a one-time conversation. Hey, they're 6 or 7 now. I hope they can understand. I'll tell them, whoo, we got through that. Now we don't have to bring it up again. Not at all. We have, there's a gal who's in the support group who's attended regularly over the last decade or so. And her kids, you know, they've had that conversation at maybe age 10, 11, mm-hmm. but it wasn't a regular part of their conversation. And at age 13, they were surprised. They'd forgotten, right? And then all of a sudden they're reprocessing that grief and that frustration and maybe a sense of betrayal that the universe wasn't quite the way they felt it had been presented to them. So
I
like to encourage folks, it's a story, it's a process, and at first it's just about becoming familiar with talking about it yourself so that you can talk about it. And then later on it's just about, you know, being age appropriate and helping the kids understand. And so, I mean, there's a lot more we could talk about that, Nick, but
yeah.
You know, that's been our experience for 15 years. So I think that need to give back, I think I'll just bring it back to that here, is that the way we're giving back is by trying to, or paying forward, if you will, is by trying to be there for folks, just like there were some brave folks who were willing to risk being recognized and sit around in a support group circle and talk about what they were going through 15 years ago, you know, for people to.
Yeah, I think that's, I've really enjoyed just listening to you telling everyone that. But I think it's, especially like from my perspective anyway, because obviously the wife being pregnant, and obviously there's going to come a stage in the future where we are going to tell them, like I've said. But obviously, it's good to speak to someone whose kids are older.
It's so helpful.
And you've been through it, and you know what I mean? It's all good. And it's good to know that, like, it's good to just hear it from someone. You know what I mean? Like, you came out the other end and it all worked out. I mean, it's
so helpful. Like, your mileage is going to vary. You know, your mileage may vary, as the expression goes, but it's so helpful to just gather different perspectives, how people have been working through it, how they've been adapting, you know, how the kids are adapting, you know, all of that. Nick, it's just so encouraging and so supportive.
I think for me as well, the good thing about me having the interviews with everybody for the podcast is exactly what you just said, is getting everyone's views and everyone's different perspectives and hearing everybody's different stories, because everyone's different. And it just opens your eyes a little bit to the different situations, and this can happen and that can happen. And you know what I mean? There's so much that can happen literally in this whole journey. And it's good to get the perspectives and the stories from everyone, because chances are you're going to relive some of these stories down your journey at some stage anyway.
That's it.
So least you've got something to go off. I mean, may not have to go down everything that you've done or everything that I've done or
so on,
but least you've got something to give you maybe a little hint or there's that small stepping stone of, yeah, okay, you've gone go that far with my help. Now it's giving you the impetus to kind of go and do it your way, hopefully.
Nick, this is why your podcast is so important and the work that you're doing is so good. Not only are you helping guys recognize other people have been through this, but you're presenting to them as you interview folks and as you talk about your own journey, you're presenting and making available for folks another point of reference, another chance to hear about something that's just not talked about enough. Mm-hmm. And it's just so important. You are able to do exactly what you just described through MIP. Yeah. And I mean, I'm a fan. I love what you're doing. And I think, you know, you got to do what's right for you. Keep it up as long as you can, want to or whatever. But I think it's what you're doing here is already valuable for creating those kind of conversations you just described.
Yeah. Well, I will continue doing this anyway for as long as I can, or as long as feasible.
As long as it works for you. Absolutely.
Exactly. Exactly. So, do you want to tell everyone about the support group, the Donors Conception Canada, and just tell us? I'm sure there's going to be hopefully some guys who listen in Canada, and they may want to get in touch with you.
Absolutely. So our website is donorconception.com. Doesn't get much harder or easier than that. Donorconception.com. We actually own a few URLs and they all point to our website. Our website's static. I don't spend a lot of time on it, but we have an active Facebook page and community, which you'll find Donor Conception Canada on Facebook. And we also have a mailing list and email list if you're geographically close to where we're hosting meetings. And we were, just before the pandemic struck, we were just about to have a friend and associate host the first meeting in Vancouver. You know, sort of affiliated with what we're doing, and whether we're kind of directly reaching out and starting up new conversations, whether we're inspiring others to do that, we think it's a win. So go to donorconception.com. You can reach me at info@donorconception.com. That comes to me. We can point you to resources and support, you know, if you're in Canada or not. We're just here to help, and please write and reach out, and we'll do whatever we can to support you for sure.
Brilliant. and I'll put all of the links to everything in the show notes. And also, I've also made a Facebook page now for the Male Infertility Podcast.
It just, excellent.
I thought it would be easier because on Instagram, there's only so much you can put into a post. And you can't put like URLs or so on. And I just think, I mean, I can continue on Instagram, but they're on the Facebook page itself. It's easier to find these things. You know what I mean? You just click on a link.
It's a convenient platform, right? A page lets you post news articles with comment. Yeah. You can start an associated group for private discussion. Yeah, it's a pretty good tool for that, for sure.
So yeah, so I'll put everything on the show notes for this, and then anyone can find you and get in contact with you, and hopefully you can share some of your knowledge and experiences with them personally, maybe, hopefully. So
I'd love to, Nick. And if there's anything we can do together in the future, you know, I should make the obligatory offer. If you ever find yourself in the other London, you know, or Toronto, you know, we'd love to have you as a guest at a meeting. This has been really, really a great conversation. I really appreciate your moderation and the invitation, you know, just to try and help beat back some of the stigma and support guys. And I look forward to, you know, however we can work together in the future.
It's cool, man. It's been my pleasure having you on the podcast. It really has.
Thanks, man.
So thank you. Thank you, Vince.
Thank you.
Okay, so that's the interview done. And I just want to say thank you once again to Vince. It was a pleasure and an honor speaking with you, sir. Thank you very much. So all the links and so on are going to be in the description, like I've said. If you haven't found me before, you know where you can find me. It's Instagram, The Male Infertility Podcast. I'm on Facebook, The Male Infertility Podcast. You can also, I don't know if you can do it on Spotify or Apple Podcasts, but I have actually made a special page on my voice acting website, which is Nick Denton VA. There's a link at the top, like a little menu. You can click on that. It takes you to the MIP bit, and you can download each episode. So you can just take it wherever you like and so on. So that option's there. Thanks for listening, guys. I really appreciate it, as always. And this is the MIP, signing off. See ya.